I know, I just feel more comfortable if, don't worry, it'll be total secret witness. Black silhouette, disguised voice, the whole package. At least until the school changes. So, you're doing a video this time? Yep, viral. That's the audience we really need to reach anyway, the non-establishment market. It's going to be like Kony 2012, but with a better follow-through. And you and I will be able to say we were here at the start. Wow, some of this is still getting through to me. That's the other thing, said Allison, stomach tightening. You can't tell anyone that I introduced you. Is that okay? I really went totally behind Miss Lawrence and Mr. Danvers and everyone to keep her secret. There was a thoughtful pause from the other end. You know, Allison, you should stop worrying about offending people like that. History's going to leave them behind. The older generation have to get out of our way sooner or later. Who cares what they think? Right, said Allison uneasily. Just don't tell them anyway, you know, while they're still around. Hmm? Oh, sure. Gotta go, Allison. I'm calling around for a crew. Thanks again. Allison stared at the blank screen of her phone and heaved a sigh that made her entire mouth vibrate. She had hardly slept a wink since making the introduction between Nita and Jessica. She kept imagining she could hear the sound of Richard Danvers shouting in apoplectic rage, underlaid with the steady, sarcastic drone of Elizabeth. When she opened the newsagent's door and was startled to a quiver by the jingling bell, she felt it was time to calm down. She took deep breaths in time with her slow steps towards Diablerie and the car. You can't please everyone. In the confines of her head, she chanted it like a mantra. You can't please everyone. She wondered who had come up with the phrase. Probably not someone who had had to worry about future career prospects. Diablerie was making a series of bizarre gestures with his hands when Allison returned, chanting his usual stream of random mystic-sounding nonsense. He concluded by circling his thumbnail around his entire face and flicking it forwards, finishing his chant with a triumphant roar as he did so. Thy household is cursed to the eighth generation. May your forebears live to regret the insult you have made upon Diablerie. Allison followed his gaze and saw a young woman in a puffy anorak walking speedily away with a 10-year-old boy on one arm tottering to keep up. What happened? Another wretched mouse scurrying about this refuse tip of civilization, said Diablerie, still staring at the mother's retreating back, of the opinion that her offspring's age grants him license to insult with impunity. From this day forth, they shall know the curse of humiliating prickle. Oh. Allison searched her phone for the email Danvers had sent along. Yes, sneered Diablerie. When every doctor's appointment becomes rife with intrusive questions, then we shall know who is truly that tosser. Allison gave a little cough to signal the change of subject. The address should be just around the corner. Yes, what trivial task awaits Diablerie, now that I lie in disgrace for having failed to intuit that Lawrence thinks me some glorified babysitter. We're supposed to be going to the address where the Fluidic Killer YouTube video was uploaded from? She read from her phone. And Mr. Danvers wants us to particularly see if there's anything that links it to someone called Mike Badge. A simple divination, crowed Diablerie. The forces of beyond shall guide us to the forsaken place. The cloud of guilt that hangs upon it shall mark it on the spiritual map like an ink stain. We already know the address. It's... began Allison, before looking up to see Diablerie already stalking down the pavement, making mystic hand gestures in front of his face, in a way that from behind looked like he was thumbing his nose. She gave a little sigh and jogged to catch up. He seemed to be heading towards the right street. She suspected that he already knew perfectly well what the address was, as she had read it aloud more than once while programming the GPS. The street was narrow, with a bare minimum room for two lanes of cars and pavements just wide enough for single file, so that the denizens of the terraced shops and maisonettes could have tapped on the windows of their opposite neighbours if they had had an extendable ladder or two taped-together brooms. The address that Danvers' directions led to was a door beside a small takeaway shop. The frosted glass in the window did little to disguise the fact that it led to a pokey staircase, in turn leading to the maisonette above the shop. Diablerie was about to walk straight past it when he stopped dead and thrust his walking cane towards the door. Allison, still hurrying to keep up, was very nearly smashed across the nose. "Here," he intoned. "It is here that the darkness gathers." Alison tried the handle of the door, locked, which hardly came unexpected. She looked up at the first floor windows. They were darkened, but the blinds were open.
"Aye!"
The door to the takeaway was open, and the head of a straggly-haired middle-aged woman poked out. She had angry little black eyes buried in the folds of her face, and the kind of voice that sounded like she was trying to use her statements as offensive weapons.
"You friends with Chris?"
she asked, firing the words from her chubby mouth like shotgun blasts. "What?" said Alison, guiltily releasing the door handle as if it had become red-hot.
"You tell him. If he's going to rent my upstairs, I expect him to use it more than once a blooming fortnight. I could be having someone else using it when he's not in."
Diablerie had gone into boggle-eyed, cloak-wrapped-around-face mode, so Alison took charge of the discourse. We don't know them, actually," she said. "Do you know where we can find them?" The folds of the shop owner's brow crumpled with concern as she looked Diablerie up and down.
"You coppers!"
"We are agents of the Crown," announced Diablerie, hurling his cloak aside with a flourish. "We have come to investigate the deeds of he who most recently occupied these rooms. We fully intend to poke our nose in all associated places. Reveal your secrets, good woman."
"Oh!"
The shop owner's fingers drummed on the doorframe.
"I don't know now. Never seen him. He works funny hours or summat."
She disappeared back inside, slamming the door closed so violently that the blatantly unrepresentative picture of a tasty-looking kebab partially came away from the glass. "I don't think she'll open up to us now," said Alison, with a hint of reproach.
"Ha! Do you never tire of lying face down in the wet sand at the shores of the ocean of foolishness?"
He pared his usual boggle eyes with a wolfish grin. "The wheels of Diablerie's scheme are in motion as we speak. Come, join me in the buffet car, and I shall salve thy ignorance." 38. Jess.
Hey.
Dr. Nita Pavani.
Hello.
Thank you again so much for agreeing to this. I really think this could be the beginning of a whole new world for interdimensionally gifted persons like you and your brother.
Okay.
No need to be nervous. You can talk completely freely here on private chat. All we're going to do today is fill in some details. I'd like to ask some broad questions that you can answer in your own time in as much detail as you want. Is that okay?
Yes.
Great. So, how exactly were you first brought to the school?
They just came and took us away.
The ministry agents?
Think so.
Okay. Remember, you can answer with as much detail as you want. How did they become aware of you and Aaron?
Well, they came the day after I went to the doctor about my sweating, and Aaron had just made everyone at school think Mrs. Irving was a duck.
Okay. If it's not too painful to remember, why don't you tell me about your first impressions of the magic school? Take your time.
Well, we got there, and we got taken to this office, and there was a man there.
Can you tell me what the man did to you, Jessica?
He said there was something very special inside us, and he was going to show us how to use it.
And then?
And then he gave us Mars bars, and showed us our room.
Okay. What was your room like?
Small. There was hardly anything in it but two beds, two desks, and the connecting bathroom with a bidet, and one of those little fridges they have in hotels.
Hang on a second. I just want to clarify. We are talking about the prison school here.
Oh, sorry. This was the first school.
How many schools are we dealing with? 39. Diablerie and Alison rented the room above a pub opposite the suspicious maisonette. The owners of the pub had been trying to turn it into a trendy, youth-oriented venue and weren't in the business of letting rooms, but Diablerie's persistence and the holes his walking cane were leaving in the multicolored dance floor eventually won them around. Alison found herself by the window in the upstairs storage room, perched on a crate of fruity vodka drinks. Diablerie stood nearby, eyes closed and hands waving, as if listening to classical music. The pub had been the nearest place, and describing it as opposite the maisonette was somewhat overgenerous.
It was a good 8 or 9 doors down, but the maisonette was still visible if Alison partially leaned out of the window and used the binoculars that Diablerie had produced from some mysterious pocket in his suit.
"You said you would fill me in on the plan?" prompted Alison warily.
Diablerie's hands froze and his eyes snapped open. "Ready to turn thy back on the oceans of ignorance?"
"Yes, I'm that thing."
"'Tis well!" He took 2 long strides that placed him beside the window. "Diablerie's scheme hinges thusly. The lower orders are a confrontational bunch amongst themselves, but there is one thing that will unite them."
"What's that?" Alison sensed he wouldn't continue until she asked.
"A common foe, and there is no greater foe to the common than authority. Whatever petty rapprochement exists between that harpy and her tenant will swiftly be forgotten now that she perceives the terrible shadow of the law overhead. Diablerie wagers she wasted no time in informing him of our presence."
"You think so?"
"Diablerie does not think so. Diablerie is friend only to certainties, and it is my certainty that the creature that did its dark deeds within that maisonette will be swift to return there, to erase their stagnant droppings. All we need to do is lie in wait."
"So this is a stakeout?"
"Spare me your gutter dialect. Keep watch upon the accursed household. I shall monitor our surroundings through the less mundane methods."
He made to resume his weird hand gestures.
"Just one thing," said Alison quickly, before he put himself in a trance again. "Are you sure it's an absolute certainty? He might get frightened off, or that woman might not want any more trouble."
Diablerie drew himself up, offering the full force of his glare.
"You dare to question Diablerie?"
"No." He drew himself even further, standing on tiptoe to enhance the effect.
"You dare to go back on your words?"
"I'm sorry," cringed Alison. "Which one was worse?"
Diablerie lowered himself with a sneer. "Leave the thinking to me, girl. Trust in Diablerie's ineffable wisdom. There is solidarity within all lower orders of life, with the possible exception of tainted ones."
Alison hung her head and resolutely took up the binoculars again, but Diablerie had temporarily blinded himself to signals.
"Like your friends," said Diablerie wheedlingly. "The fire elemental and the sniffer dog. What better example could there be for the wretchedness of the taint, incapable of tolerating even itself?"
"But Adam and Victor have worked together for—"
"I speak not of their brittle fraternity. I speak of their campaign to hunt their fellow hellspawn. No sooner was their taint identified than they employed it against their own kind. Be ever mindful of any who so easily betray their body and soul."
Alison gave in, lowering the binoculars.
"But, Doctor, they didn't have a choice." "Pah! Diablerie has more respect for the creatures we exterminate. At least they show loyalty to a cause, be it the evil cause of the ancients' war upon humanity."
Alison strongly suspected that Diablerie was testing her, or deliberately trying to drive her away so that he could be free of scrutiny at last, in which case the smartest response would have been to brush it off and quietly get on with her task. But out of nowhere, she thought of Nita Pavani, and the confidence with which she threw out her bold ideas. She talked and acted like she refused to change to win the approval of others. Alison wanted to become just like her.
"I think you're wrong," said Alison, bracing herself.
Diablerie slowly cocked his head. His voice was like cold magma gradually descending a gentle slope.
"What did you say?"
The fact that he had not responded with fierce dictatorial ranting did nothing to ease Alison's nerves.
"I said, I think, maybe, you might be wrong."
"Possibly."
"Maybe the ancients aren't all working against humanity. Maybe there's not some big plan behind it all." "Not working against humanity!" roared Diablerie, incredulously pulling his cloak tighter around himself. "They work against humanity from within our very souls, corrupting our newborns with their insidious taint."
"I know, I know." Alison had unconsciously brought one of her knees up to her chest and was now perched on the crate of bottles in a partial fetal position.
"But that doesn't mean they have a plan. Maybe they like the fluidics. Maybe they just want a chance to live."
Diablerie backed off, narrowed his eyes, and made a dramatic half-turn on his heel. "So," he said, apparently addressing the door, "you think you have learned enough to challenge Diablerie in the field of debate?"
"I'd just like to know what makes you certain that they're evil," she said, weakly.
He spun back around, his cloak twirling hypnotically, and stabbed a pointed finger. "Quake at Diablerie's mastery of logic! Why infect the youth with seductive power, if not intending such powers to be used? Why arm their slaves, if not in the aid of further conquest? You are ensnared in the mire of Diablerie's invincible reason."
"No, wait, hang on," stammered Allison. "You're talking about magic powers, right? Well, if they're part of some invasion plan, then why are some of the powers completely useless? Like the glowing hair thing, or sweating too much. Isn't it all completely random?"
Diablerie went quiet. Again, he slowly cocked his head from one side to the other, his face rotating like the needle of a pressure gauge. "So," he said lowly, "know you of someone who sweats too much?" A little instinct that had been trying to get Allison's attention now grabbed her forebrain by the throat and shook it back and forth, yelling, "Stupid, stupid, stupid!" She forced herself to freeze her expression and maintain eye contact as she mentally turned out her bottomless internal filing cabinet and hunted through the papers. How could she know of Jessica Weatherby's sweating power? Had it been in her file? Not the pages Allison had seen, but there had been others, through which Diablerie had dismissively picked. Did Diablerie know Jessica's power? If not, why did he want to know if Allison knew? If so, did he already know that Allison knew? Did he know that she knew that he knew? What was she supposed to know again? His stare wasn't letting up after 5 seconds, and Allison needed a quick reply. "I just heard about it from somewhere." Diablerie sneered at a few circuits around his mouth. "From somewhere?" he repeated mockingly. "How uncharacteristically vague." She came to a decision. "It was Jessica Weatherby's power, wasn't it?" she said, sitting up straight. "Aaron Weatherby's sister, the one we couldn't find. It said so in her file." Diablerie raised an eyebrow. Of course, the possibility existed that her file had said nothing of the sort, and that Diablerie knew that, and now also knew that Allison was lying. She shifted uncomfortably as her embarrassed blush spread to every nook and cranny of her flesh, and tried to will away her growing headache. "Ah, yes," said Diablerie in a bored tone, breaking the tension at last. "The tainted girl who has somehow eluded all efforts to track her, and whom you now claim to not be dangerous?"
"Well, not because she has the power of sweating too much." "What possible danger could that be?"
Diablerie opened his mouth condescendingly, but swiftly closed it again as no words came. His gaze tracked away, and he began to thoughtfully smooth down his moustache with his thumb and index finger. "One could slip in it?" he offered, without confidence. "One could—" "Gah! Diablerie tires of this asinine debate!" He pointed a thin finger at the binoculars that still hung loosely from Allison's hands. "Your task was to watch the accursed maisonette! It has been without scrutiny for minutes now!" Allison looked down.
"Oh, right, sorry."
"Foolish girl!" He made for the door. "The trooping of the colour could have taken place below the window. Diablerie shall inspect the door for interference and return. Waver not from thy task again."
The maisonette door looked fairly uninterfered with from where Allison was sitting, but she remained silent as the sound of Diablerie stomping down the stairs faded away. Stewing in an unaccountable sense of guilt, she resolved to avoid winning arguments in future.
40. Drawing information out of Jessica Weatherby had been as exhausting an experience as Allison had warned, and Nita Pavani was taking a moment to recharge. She stood before the drinks machine in the little kitchenette near her office, perusing the energy drink logos and trying to remember which parent companies she was supposed to be boycotting.
"Doctor," said Elizabeth Lawrence, materializing by her side to fill a water jug from the kitchenette sink.
"Miss Lawrence," returned Nita. With the formalities concluded, she turned slightly toward her and put her hands on her hips. "Why was I not informed that there are two schools?"
"I assumed you had done sufficient research,"
said Elizabeth casually, putting the merest barely detectable speck of emphasis on the word assumed. "Well, from what my research has indicated," said Nita, placing a considerably more obvious emphasis on research, "this initial school sounds like an ideal learning environment for the interdimensionally gifted. I want to inspect it as soon as possible."
"Naturally. Danvers can arrange. Make sure to let me know your recommendations."
Nita tensed up further. All her limbs stiffened in place and her teeth started to hurt. "I will be sure to do that."
"Excellent."
Neither woman moved or broke eye contact. Nita broke the silence. "I'm fairly certain I know what I will be recommending, if everything I have heard is true. The secondary school should be closed, and the primary school should be expanded to offer complete education of the interdimensionally gifted." Elizabeth shifted her weight, groping the handle of her cane.
"If you can put together a rough plan of action in the next few days, I'm sure we can reach a satisfactory compromise within the next week."
Nita broke. "What have you done?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"You've done something, haven't you, to make this all pointless? What was it this time, another leak to the press? Or you've warned them ahead of time, and I'll show up, and the whole place will be razed to the ground?" She took a fearful step backward. "That's it. You're trying to make me paranoid?"
Elizabeth sighed. "Dr. Pavani, please. I have no interest in sabotaging your work with the schools. All I want is for us to get past this silliness and find a place where we can meet halfway."
Her mouth twisted a little as if trying to suck on a sharpened pear drop without lacerating her tongue.
"I apologize if I have come across as hostile."
Pavani's gaze darted around, looking for the trick, before furrowing her brow in thought and refocusing on Elizabeth. "Did Sean give you an ultimatum?" Elizabeth's phone made an insistent noise, and she seized the opportunity to break eye contact.
"Excuse me," she said with growing concern, as she read the words on the screen.
It was from Danvers, simply stating, "Come to my office urgently, but not in a way that looks urgent." She left the kitchenette and peered down the avenue of cubicles to Danvers' office. Danvers himself was standing in the open doorway, still holding his phone and waving slightly manically with his free hand. "Close the door behind you," said Danvers, after Elizabeth had nonchalantly hobbled her way over. She obeyed, gently pushing the door shut with two fingers as she watched him move behind his desk, not sitting down.
"What is it?" she said.
He rotated his monitor around. "Allison's issued credit card was stolen," he said, in a flat voice that bubbled with internal tension. "I've been going over the charges the thief made, seeing if there were any we could get back." Elizabeth inspected the spreadsheet, and her eyes glazed over almost instantly.
"What am I looking at?"
"Most of it's rubbish, consumer electronics, internet downloads, pizza deliveries. But there are also purchases of train and bus tickets, back and forth, all over the country. Including," he pointed out two highlighted lines, "two visits to Oakhampton Station, a short distance from the site of the fluidic murders." Without taking her eyes off the screen, Elizabeth rapidly pulled out a chair and sat.
"When?"
"I think you could guess. The first, about a week before Kaysen and Hesketh discovered the first dead fluidic. The second, the very morning of the Dartmoor Forest fire."
"So whoever stole Allison's card is a very strong candidate for the fluidic killer."
Danvers bit his lip.
"Is it possible that Allison could have lied about it being stolen?"
He and Elizabeth both glanced away for a few brief seconds of intense thought, then simultaneously met each other's gaze again.
"No," Danvers decided. "No, not her. Anyway, she has an alibi for the second killing. She was with Kaysen and Hesketh as it was taking place."
"Assuming we can trust all of them, assuming the three of them aren't conspiring, could they be?"
There was another, even shorter, bout of thoughtful glances.
"No."
"No, probably not."
Elizabeth pulled her chair in closer.
"Do we know precisely when the card was stolen?"
"Allison says she only ever made one charge with it, so it had to be between then and the time of the second charge." He pointed to the very top of the list. "That was on the evening of the same day, the day of her first assignment with
diablerie,"
finished Elizabeth. Danvers didn't like the low, hungry way in which she had pronounced the word, nor the way she squeezed her walking cane handle.
"If we're believing Allison's account, then he has an alibi for the second killing as well." "I'm not convinced that he does."
"The other three all say he was in the toilet when the second killing started."
No, they said he went into a toilet and was out of view when the second killing started. Allison specifically mentioned that he was taking abnormally long and being unusually quiet. Danvers folded his arms. How about we look for a theory that fits all the facts and not for facts that fit the current theory? Why would he buy a train ticket to the place he was going to be driven to? He hates magical creatures, said Elizabeth, dodging the question. He says so constantly. None of us know what he does in his private life, and we've suspected for some time that he has a hidden agenda. Danvers rubbed his brow with thumb and forefinger. No, Elizabeth, you have. You are the one who insists on keeping him employed. What about all these other payments? You really think Diablerie has a fondness for... He leaned in to read off a random entry. Season 1 and 2 of Ritsuko versus the Space Bastard. Obfuscation, said Elizabeth stubbornly. It seems to be one of his specialties. Richard did a small circuit of the room, letting all the air out from his lungs in a single slow hiss. You seriously want to do this? You want to finger one of our own people? On this evidence? I agree it's hardly conclusive, but it's conclusive enough. The fluidic killer is the issue of the day. Every second we show no progress undermines the department further. Having a suspect in custody will mean a lot. To us, and to everyone living in fear. She met his gaze. People have died, Richard. His mouth hung open. This is quite a reversal. What happened? Have we had an ultimatum or something? 41. Still sitting at the window of the room above the pub, Allison watched Diablerie stride along the street towards the Maisonette. There was something almost musical about his pompous gait. With every step he raised his walking stick and brought the point around in a wide circle before returning it to the ground, billowing his cloak in an identical pattern each time. She told herself that she wasn't spying, she was watching out for attack. She wasn't entirely sure what she could do to help him if an attacker did appear, but that was a bridge to cross when she came to it. The street was bathed in the cold blue light of late afternoon, but there was still enough light to see the Maisonette door. It was little more than a sliver at this distance, but the bright frontage of the takeaway shop was impossible to miss. Diablerie slowed as he approached, stopped dead to stand with affronted dignity at the jovial honk of a passing car, then pinned himself to the wall and began to creep the remaining distance to the door. Allison assumed he was trying to go unnoticed by the people in the takeaway shop. When he was close enough to the Maisonette door, he planted his feet to one side of it and leaned over to inspect the handle. Apparently seeing no sign that anything had changed, he leaned back. He glanced left and right, then took something from the band of his top hat. He had his back to Allison, and his cloak was muddling his silhouette, but she could tell that he was working at the door handle. She thought he might have been dusting for fingerprints, until the door suddenly fell open and Diablerie disappeared inside. He picked the lock, she realized. Her pulse quickened as she further realized that he was now out of sight, and bad things had a tendency to happen when Diablerie was out of sight. This development was threatening to invite all of Miss Lawrence's terrible and wrathful sarcasm. Allison lowered her binoculars and stood up. She was planning to make for the stairs and chase after him, until she saw a battered Range Rover pull up and park directly below her window. She recognized the number plate from the email that Danvers had sent along. It was Mike Badger's vehicle. Moments later, Mike Badger himself emerged from the driver's seat, and Allison endeavored to duck out of sight. He looked exactly as he had done in the file photo Danvers had sent. She was pretty sure he was wearing the exact same clothing. The same flat cap, tweed jacket, and Wellington boots. He moved around the car to the back and opened the boot. The car was parked so close, and more to the point, the buildings in this area were so squat, that even from a first-floor window, Allison could plainly see the entire contents. There were a number of ragged cardboard boxes disgorging ammunition and occult paraphernalia onto the floor, as well as a plastic shopping bag containing a selection of frozen pies, 2 beef and onion, 1 chicken and mushroom, one that just cryptically boasted meat. Probably not important details, but she couldn't help memorizing them anyway. There was also a double-barreled antique shotgun lying across the headrests of the back seat, which Mike Badger took up lovingly, resting it on one shoulder as he closed the boot with his free hand. He then headed up the street, straight toward the Maisonette, not entirely to Allison's surprise. She returned to her spot on the crates and watched him through the binoculars. This was certainly a development, but she couldn't get her head around what it meant. Was Badger the tenant of the Maisonette? the one who had uploaded the video? Excitement swelled in her chest. Had they identified the fluidic killer? It was an appealingly straightforward answer. After all, he was definitely a fluidic killer, or at least had been before first contact. But she was hardly in a position to march down, slap a hand on his shoulder, and declare him to be nicked. Besides, something felt off. She kept watching. She had no way of contacting Diablerie. He had told her that he refused to carry a phone, giving the oblique explanation that such a thing would be too obvious. All she could do was watch as Badger's stubby, round-shouldered form reached the door, readied the gun, and knocked. That cast doubt on the theory that Badger was the one renting the room, as did parking so far down the street, on reflection. After waiting a token few seconds for a reply to his knock, Badger tried the handle, found it unlocked, and within seconds had vanished inside. A few moments later, the light in the first floor window came on. Alison's excitement was rising to the level of full-blown panic. There was no more avoiding the fact that she was going to have to go down there herself, either to break up or spy on whatever was going on in there. She lowered the binoculars. She caught the merest glimpse of an upward-staring face in the passenger window of Badger's Range Rover before instinct took over, and she flew to one side, pinning herself against the wall, heart in mouth. Frequently accompanied by teenage son, a line from Danvers' email. He'd even underlined it. Why hadn't she considered he'd be there? How long had she been half-hanging out of the window, staring with slack jaw like a peeping Tom? Why didn't she ever think? She slowly massaged her heart back into her chest with deep, calming breaths, then slowly leaned toward the window, inch by inch, until she could see the car through the corner of her eye. David Badger, if it was him, was now inspecting the smartphone in his lap. Maybe he hadn't spotted her. Alison couldn't be sure. What she could be sure of was that he would definitely spot her if she now left the pub to check on the maisonette. She spent what felt like a mere handful of seconds considering what course of action would present the smallest possibility of cock-up before she heard approaching footsteps and leaned out a little in time to see Mike Badger return, still holding his unfired shotgun. "Anything there?" asked David, with no apparent genuine interest, as Mike climbed back into the driver's seat. "Nah," he replied. "Hang about, just gonna call it in." Alison couldn't see him through the roof of his car, but she heard a sequence of grunts, sighs, and faint electronic boops. "Hey up, Danvers," said Badger. "Nah, nout there. At the estate. Yep, got it. 6 o'clock. Alison crouched, but it did nothing to help her hear what the person on the other end of the phone was saying. All she could hear was a tinny gibber. "Dat it," said Badger in response. "Literally just looked at it now, calling from the car." "Hm? Yeah, I know. I had to pick up some stuff for me tea first." The gibber took on a slightly offended tone. "Look, unless you're willing to run some pies over to the wife while I'm doing shat for you, then stop complaining." He hung up unceremoniously and gunned the engine, which started after a couple of tired mechanical belches. Alison waited for the car to turn out of the street, in case any of the occupants had eyes on the rearview mirror, then bolted for the stairs. She pushed her way through a thin crowd of early evening drinkers and burst out into the street in a spray of scattered apologies. She was almost out of breath and seeing bright spots before her eyes by the time she reached the maisonette door and practically collapsed onto the handle, after she had fallen in a heap on the interior floor and nearly concussed herself on the stairs. It occurred to her that she should probably have made a quieter approach. As a compromise, she closed the front door as quietly as possible to minimize the clicking of the latch, then crept up the stairs, wincing with every creak. The space above the takeaway shop was a single empty room with bare floorboards. Other than the one she had entered, there was only one door, which hung open to reveal a pokey toilet roughly the size of a telephone booth. The room was undoubtedly the one in which the fluidic killer video had been filmed. She recognized the unique pattern of marks and stains on the wall opposite the entrance. The final clinching giveaway was the crumpled paper wizard mask lying in the corner. Besides that, the room appeared to be completely empty. She slowly turned 360 degrees, taking in every detail of the whitewashed walls and splintery floor. No doubt about it, there was nothing and nobody here. Baffled, she turned back towards the stairs. Diablerie was directly behind her. Her feet left the ground for a moment, and she gave a little yelp. "You were instructed to remain where you were," he said accusingly. "Sorry," squeaked Alison automatically. But I saw him. I saw Badger. He came in here, didn't he?
Indeed. Diablerie finally dropped his contemptful stare and began to stalk about the room, idly inspecting its limited features. That foul northern dwarf came to this place, did nothing but glance around, make truly despicable use of the water closet, then depart. Allison glanced from the toilet to the entrance door.
So what did you do?
He gave her a condescending look. I hid. Under the circumstances, thought Allison, this was the least of all relevant matters.
Doctor, this is the room, she announced. This is where they shot the fluidic killer video.
Diablerie glanced around, then tried to look convincingly all-knowing.
Is that just now penetrating the walls of the hollow bank vault you call a brain? It seems our friend Michael Badger is confirmed to be a person of interest, if such a phrase applies to this tedious investigation.
He stroked his moustache.
Now we must determine where he plans to go next.
I know that,
blurted out Allison excitedly, as powerless to stop the words as she would have been to stop a surge of vomit.
I overheard them talking.
She breathlessly recounted the half of a phone conversation she had witnessed. Diablerie's expression shifted gradually from bored scepticism to genuine concern. When she had finished and was eagerly looking to him for a response, he hastily shifted back to bored scepticism.
And what relevance does this furtive little eavesdrop of yours have, girl?
Allison, whose hands were still out in the ta-da gesture she had used to punctuate her story, frowned.
He's going to meet the person he was talking to.
And we know not where.
He called him Danvers, insisted Allison. And he mentioned an estate. I think he might have meant Mr. Danvers' father. The one who used to be on the Hand of Merlin? Don't they have, like, a family estate in the country?
Diablerie folded his arms tightly and made a short, braying laugh that came out more like a squawk.
Ha! What ridiculous fancies play about thy mind like plump ponies in a daisy patch! Think you that the Hand of Merlin could have reformed into some renegade demon-hunting operation?
Well, I didn't say that, said Allison, scratching her head. But actually, the video did say something about a new hand.
Pish tosh,
barked Diablerie, tossing his head back and forth with each word like a clucking hen.
The Hand of Merlin are no more. Its members are but ineffectual babes. Clearly this trail has gone cold. We should report back to that miserable slab of concrete we must now call headquarters.
Allison's bafflement was transmuting comfortably into suspicion.
So you want to abandon the mission?
Are you questioning me?
It's just that Miss Lawrence said you had a 100% success rate for missions up to now.
Diablerie's eyes swiveled to the side as he digested this. Then he reaffirmed himself, bobbing shallowly on his heels.
Yes, well, a streak must end some time. The truly wise, among whom Diablerie is assuredly counted, must know when they are defeated.
So we'll go back to London.
Without delay!
And report in to Miss Lawrence and to Mr. Danvers.
Diablerie stiffened a little, as our profession demands.
And they'll agree with you that this wasn't worth investigating.
His eyes spun in three complete circles as he considered this. Then he turned on his heel and swatted at nothing in particular with his cane.
Well, Diablerie sees that this fanciful notion of yours has embedded itself so deeply into your swamp-like mind that he is helpless to dissuade you. Very well. We shall repair to the Danvers estate. But Diablerie states now that this journey shall end only with disappointment. The Hand of Merlin's influence is gone from this world, and Diablerie certainly knows of no secret information to the contrary.
He took a gold pocket watch out of his waistcoat, which Allison was completely unsurprised to see that he owned.
6 o'clock, you heard him say. The hour is past that. Behold now the uncanny deductive powers of Diablerie. They must have meant 6 o'clock of a different day.
Right. He threw up a pointed finger like it was a conductor's baton.
Go, bring hither the car. We will find a place of repast and make for the Danvers Manor come 6 o'clock tomorrow evening.
They could have meant 6 in the morning, offered Allison, wanting to contribute.
Diablerie glared. Nobody arranges a meeting for 6 in the morning, girl, unless they're dueling to the death. 42. 3 steps from the maisonette door, Alison was stopped in her tracks by the buzzing of a phone in her back pocket. It was the outdated one that Elizabeth had given her, and which she had apparently forgotten about. She dug it out and squinted at the words on the dim little LED screen. "Diable is fluidic killer suspect," they read. "VC plus AH en route to apprehend. Act natural, but do not leave alone. EL." Alison looked up at the maisonette window, swallowing back anxious nausea. It was still lit, but there was no sign of movement. She had not only left Diablerie alone, she had left him alone in what was very indirectly the scene of a crime he may have been involved in. Then again, she was also under orders to act natural, and coming straight back up without fetching the car and sticking to Diablerie like a limpet would not be the best way to do that. On the basis that act natural had come first in the list of orders, she decided to compromise by fetching the car slightly faster than she had been. As she lowered the phone, she glimpsed a flurry of movement at her feet and saw a grey squirrel darting away into the encroaching evening twilight. It reappeared beneath a streetlight on the opposite pavement, where a number of other squirrels appeared to be waiting. There must have been at least 10 in the ring of orange light, and they were swiftly joined by another 10, then another, gathering from the surrounding shadows. Alison's pace slowed as she drew opposite the growing parliament of squirrels. They weren't wildly squirming around each other as she would have expected. They were all standing perfectly still, except for their bushy tails, which swayed gently in the breeze like a miniature cornfield. She couldn't see any pile of discarded nuts or an attractive lady squirrel that might have explained it. If anything, they were watching the one squirrel that Alison had nearly stepped on, which was standing slightly apart from the others. Alison's pace slowed to a complete halt as she realized that the lead squirrel was staring directly at her, curling its tail like the cocked hammer of a gun. Its little eyes were eerie pinpoints of yellow light. The rest of the squirrel parliament followed its gaze, and 100 more pairs of yellow dots appeared like a heap of Christmas lights. She could definitely sense magic in the air. She wondered if some of Adam's ability had rubbed off during one of his bouts of hover-handing. She slowly took a step back towards the maisonette, keeping her hands on display and maintaining eye contact with as many squirrels as possible. The lead squirrel burst into life and dashed toward Alison in a manic frenzy. Before she had even processed this, it had closed the distance and leapt onto her leg. She felt the soft digs of its little claws all the way up her jeans, her coat, and down her right arm, before the squirrel clamped all 4 of its limbs around her wrist. She shook her arm, but the squirrel only hugged tighter. It closed its eyes and rubbed its head against the back of her hand adorably. There was no pain. It wasn't digging its claws in, but it threatened to cut the circulation off to her hand if it cuddled any harder. Whatever this was about, only one course of action sprang to mind. Diablerie needed to see it. She made to head back. A second squirrel launched itself at Alison and found purchase on her left arm, taking up the same position as its fellow on her right and giving her a matching pair of squirrel bracelets. She inspected them, confused. Then she looked up and saw the entire squirrel horde streaming across the road towards her in a shimmering streak of grey fur. If a car had driven past, it would have massacred about 30 of them at once. Alison made the initial uncertain skips of someone about to break into a sprint, but was arrested when 4 or 5 squirrels jumped onto her leading leg at once, pulling her foot back down to the ground with their combined weight. Another load swarmed onto her other leg and locked that into place, as the next wave clambered over them to reach her arms. With military precision, the squirrels arranged themselves around her limbs. The bracelets grew and grew until they became sleeves, then an entire furry sweater, clamping her elbows and shoulders into place with clusters of tiny bodies. They locked their tails together to solidify their mass. Alison tried to move her arms, but the squirrels strategically shifted their weight in unison, with the air of sleepers unconsciously pulling the blankets back over themselves, holding her still. By then, her legs had both been encased in warm grey fur from ankle to hip. She stood paralysed by squirrels, limbs held out in what looked like an aborted star jump. She could still rotate her neck, so she directed her mouth at the window of the maisonette above. "Doctor!" she yelled. "Doc!" Her words scattered as all the squirrels on the front of her body suddenly pulled,
and all the ones on her back simultaneously pushed. She staggered a few steps into the road before the squirrels smartly reversed their action, and she came to a halt behind a parked white van. Allison heard engines and saw the headlights of an oncoming car. The driver couldn't see her. She quickly formulated a horrible theory as to the squirrel's intentions and was just as quickly proved correct. When the car was less than 10 meters away, the squirrels thrust their bodies in unison again and made Allison stumble into its path. She screwed her eyes shut and a little involuntary squeal came out of her mouth as a horn blared, but the squirrels yanked her back at the last moment. She felt the breeze of the car thundering past and the wing mirror hit the squirrel on her left elbow, flinging it off into the night with a squeal of despair. She was pulled back into place behind the van, wobbling back and forth as the squirrels waited for another car. "Doctor!" she screamed. "Help!" The window above the maisonette swung open, and Diablo reappeared, leaning his entire head and shoulders out of the building. "By the spurting outgrowth of the ancients," he remarked, "can you not resist your instincts for a single moment, girl?" "What?" Diablerie thrust out a pointed finger. "Begone! Return that coat to the insane elderly woman from whom thou stole it!"
"It's not a coat, it's..."
she squeaked again as she was pushed into the path of a young couple on matching bicycles.
"They're trying to kill me!"
"Then you should not have made a coat from them! Must you bother Diablerie with all your bad decisions?"
She was shoved towards one cyclist, then the other, a split second too late to connect both times. The riders rang their bells in angry bemusement.
"Doctor, please!"
"Oh, very well. Bring them under the window."
"I can't..."
began Allison, but Diablerie had already disappeared into the building. She planted her feet and tried to lunge her entire upper body towards the pavement, but the squirrels patiently held her back with equal force. A particularly large set of headlights appeared at the far end of the road, accompanied by the roar of a heavy goods vehicle. The squirrels began to sway her left and right in preparation for another shove. Allison was streaming tears and mucus from every available hole in her face, but some tiny survival instinct managed to get hold of her. She shoved herself at the road before the squirrels could. Confused, they tried to pull her back. She quickly switched direction and threw herself toward the maisonette with full force, so that she and the squirrels were momentarily working together. It was enough to send her staggering back onto the pavement, spinning gently like an unbalanced shopping trolley. The truck sped past, splattering nobody. Allison was as close to the maisonette window as she could hope to be. The squirrels were already dragging her limbs back like bored children, and it took all of her strength to keep herself in place.
"Doctor, now!"
An agonizing second later, Diablerie reappeared, holding what looked like a loop of pink measuring tape.
"Hold still," he said bitterly, before throwing the tape like a cowboy unsure of how to lasso properly.
The circle dropped neatly around Allison and her squirrel entourage, landing in a circle around their feet. She could see now that it almost certainly was measuring tape, held in a circle with the aid of staples, but instead of numbered marks, it was adorned with a repeating series of symbols that didn't belong to any written language Allison had ever seen.
"What's that?"
she asked.
"Stage one," said Diablerie dismissively.
He was holding a smartphone toward her at arm's length. The screen bore an image of an old-fashioned gramophone with an animated wax cylinder that spun as the phone played a looping audio file. It was the voice of a woman, talking in an unceasing, bored monotone as if reading from a script. The syllables were completely unfamiliar to Allison, but she instantly knew, with a certainty she couldn't explain, that they were related to the written symbols on the circle. The sounds seemed to drill straight into the core of her subconscious without needing to wait for her ears to register them. Everything outside the circle fell away into an abyss. She and the squirrels had already stopped resisting each other. Her head became heavy. She looked down at the circle of tape around her and saw the symbols glow and pulsate as their corresponding sounds were voiced. The tight black pen strokes became narrow gateways to the depths of the multiverse. Sluggishly, her mind registered a weight being lifted from her body. One by one, the squirrels were going stiff and peeling away from the crowd. After a sharp impact with the pavement, each one promptly regained its senses and scurried away into the night.
As the last few furry bodies detached from her clothing, Alison discovered that it had only been the squirrels piled up around her legs keeping her upright. Her head hung lower, as if lead weights were attached to her ears, and she gently keeled over. As her upper body fell outside the confines of the magic circle, and her chin hit the pavement, the strange sensations instantly vanished. Reality reasserted itself in a hurry, rushing back to normalcy, as if it had merely been on the far end of a piece of stretched elastic. She lay on her front, stunned, fixing her gaze on a nearby paving slab, unwilling to move until she was absolutely positive which direction was up and which was down. She heard a door open, and Diablerie's ominous figure stalked into her field of view, silhouetted against the orange streetlight. He stepped over her prone form and recovered the magic circle. He tutted as it snagged one of her ankles, and shook it until her foot slapped limply back to the ground. "Well," he said, straightening up and taking in the scene. "The fluidic killer sends their regards, methinks. We stand compromised. We must find alternative lodgings." He glanced down. "Bring hither the car, girl. Feel free to shriek my name should thou find thyself harassed by chinchilla or shrew." 43. The alternative lodgings eventually decided upon by Diablerie consisted of a small country hotel on the outskirts of town. Alison quietly booked them two adjoining rooms as Diablerie argued loudly with the manager over whether or not the hotel was going to dry-clean his cloak for him. She considered booking a single room to better keep an eye on Diablerie, but she knew precisely how that would have gone down, and from the room next door she could at least hear him coming and going. Besides, she needed time alone to think about what Diablerie had done that afternoon. Magic? No kind of magic she'd learned about in her 6 months absorbing information at the primary school. She'd understood magic as a mysterious, chaotic, organic force that occasionally tolerated life forms to work alongside it, like a fast-flowing river that could provide a bear with salmon one day and drown its cubs the next. But Diablerie had done something scrappy and mechanical with it that instinctively felt obscene, like the river had been diverted through a rusty sewage pipe. "And he saved our life," sang an insistent little thought at the back of her mind. After 15 minutes trying to find a way to lay her head on the overstuffed pillow without it bending her neck at a right angle, she concluded that she wasn't in the mood for sleep. She laboriously squeezed herself out of the tightly tucked bedsheets, like toothpaste from a tube, and sat at the little desk, taking up a pen and a notepad that both bore the hotel's logo. "I left the maisonette at 7:18 p.m., and walked for 11 paces, she wrote. "I saw the first squirrel when it was 71 centimetres ahead of my leading foot, 47 centimetres from the edge of the pavement." When Alison had been ordered by Richard Danvers to write a detailed account of the incident at Dartmoor, she had found the work surprisingly relaxing. She had spent her whole life learning that other people weren't interested in the fine details she could supply, and her mind was forever swimming with facts that had nowhere to go. There was something cathartic about pinning them into place with pen and ink. It helped her to toss the events around and draw her own conclusions. Before long, she had filled 3 sheets. Diablerie produced a loop of pink tape approximately 3 centimetres thick with a diameter of 1.1 metres, she wrote. Along the tape was a repeating pattern of symbols drawn in black marker with an average size of around 2 centimetres wide. The symbols were as follows. She drew the first stroke of the first symbol. The next thing she knew, her head was lying on the desk, swimming in a dull, throbbing pain that lapped like a gentle tide. She scraped her wits back together and glanced around the room for the unseen attacker. But she was alone, the door still firmly locked. The ache was radiating from the center of her head. She looked down at the solitary black mark and felt a spike of pain wash over her frontal lobe. She clutched her temples, trying to remember. She had smartly slashed the mark onto the page, and at that moment her senses had been overloaded by some kind of burst behind her eyes. There had been stars and spots, and a brief noise like thousands of voices screaming at once. She inspected the pen, but it seemed none the worse. It was a flimsy plastic biro with the logo of the hotel and a misspelling of the word accommodation on the side. Experimentally, she touched the nib of the pen to the spot where she would begin the second stroke of the magic symbol.
Instantly, there was a change in the air. An increase of pressure that seemed to be on the cusp of making her ears pop. The universe was holding its breath. She began to draw the stroke, slowly this time. It didn't help. Moving the pen along the line was like dragging the head of a rake along a blackboard. The wailing resumed, but now she could hear other sounds laid into the chorus that didn't sound like they had anything to do with lungs or throats. More like harp strings being tormented with sores, or the groans of great rustling metal machines at the bottom of vast, inescapable shafts. She quickly rounded the curve, completing the symbol. The noise rose to an agonizing crescendo, and as she lifted the pen, there was another starburst around the borders of her vision. She held her forehead, waiting for the pain to subside, and a drop of blood fell from her nose and splattered onto the page. Alison quickly pushed away from the desk, clutching her face and reaching for the tissue box on the bedside table. She looked back at the lone symbol on the page. The strokes had somehow grown bolder and thicker than the rest of her handwriting. She had the unaccountable sense that it was watching her, waiting expectantly like a job interviewer who had just posed an awkward question. There were 5 more symbols in the sequence, but Alison didn't even want to think about what might start leaking from her body by the time she had drawn the last. But there was also the matter of the voice that had been coming out of Diablerie's phone, the chant that had somehow activated the written circle. She found her own smartphone and started up the app for recording voice reminders, which she had, of course, never used before. She tapped the record icon, cleared her throat, and began to chant. An infinity of colored stars emerged from the flaps and tears of reality's ragged fabric and collided before her eyes. She drifted for 1,000 years in the shadow of a vast nebulaic cloud, only for the dust to shift and reveal the curves of a tentacle bigger than galaxies. She fell, crashing into a vast purple ocean, and was tossed by violent waves until she sensed something massive shifting far beneath her, which she thought at first was a prehistoric fish 10 times the size of a blue whale, until it unfurled to reveal a black glare that darkened the entire sea, and she knew that it was an eyelid. Something pulled her under, and she struggled to breathe as she marked a tiny dot amid an abyss, crowded with tongues and teeth and fluttering motions that concertinaed away forever like an image between 2 mirrors. And then Alison was startled out of the vision by the morning sun appearing through the net curtains. She was still sitting on the side of the bed, with her phone close to her mouth, the battery long dead. She stood up. Her limbs were stiff, and there was an ache in her sitting muscles. She half-crouched, half-collapsed beside her overnight bag, and fumbled for her phone charger. She lay perfectly still on her side on the flowery carpet, staring at her phone until there was enough charge to bring it to life. The time was past 8 o'clock, but more important, a text message lit up the screen. "In Doncaster," it said. "Meet up to arrange DD pickup? Adam." 2 more text messages were directly underneath. "Sorry, you're probably asleep. Reply when possible. A." "Sorry if that sounded gruff. Long drive. Sorry. A." Alison jogged the phone in her hand, thinking. Then she quickly dressed and left the room. The hotel was small, but it was hardly peak season, and Alison was pretty sure she and Diablerie had the floor to themselves. Nevertheless, she hesitated outside his door for a few moments to double-check that the grand old house was silent, then knocked gently. Immediately she heard a short orchestra of thuds, like an arrangement of wooden objects being hurriedly dismantled. "Come no further!" shouted Diablerie through the door. "The private ways of Diablerie are not for the eyes of mortal man. You may never have restful dreams again." Alison abandoned her initial intention to ask to come in. "What's the plan today, Doctor?" Diablerie's voice came from around knee level, accompanied by the sound of something being scraped up from the carpet. "What? Oh. We will depart for the Danvers Manor at 5. Until then, the day is yours. Cringe now at Diablerie's uncanny generosity."
"Doctor, have I earned any more questions lately?"
"Shall we reflect on the previous day? Failure to follow instructions, falling prey to harmless woodland creatures, harboring wrong opinions?"
"Okay, never mind." Her hand closed around the phone in her pocket, and she turned away. Diablerie sighed with irritation.
"Ugh. Ask your question, girl."
Alison returned swiftly. "That thing you did yesterday with the circle of symbols and the chant." She swallowed.
"What was it?"
Diablerie was silent for a moment.
"You attempted to write the runes, didn't you?"
The reply caught in Alison's throat.
"Ha!" said Diablerie, amused. "Finally you show some promising curiosity. What you saw as your gormless jaw went slack at the infinite mysteries of Diablerie was rune-crafting."
"What is it?"
"The means by which even the untainted may play the infernal threads of magic that criss-cross our